This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester. A week which has seen meetings between industry leaders and politicians in Aberdeen, the city's annual decommissioning conference, a Westminster debate on fuel duty, the publication of the Oil and Gas UK Business Confidence Index, and Shell employees scoop a top health award. On Monday, industry leaders gathered with opposition MPs in Aberdeen to discuss their concerns over Tory-led government policies. The meeting came about following a recent Westminster report criticising George Osborne's surprise windfall tax on the North Sea sector. Shadow Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, Caroline Flint, attended the talks and spoke with our reporter, Rebecca Curran.
It was really interesting, very informative, and you know that's why I really like coming out of Whitehall to actually be in the places where you know the energy sector is thriving, but also to meet the companies that directly involved. And you know, it was a discussion around really some exciting developments in the oil and gas sector, but also clearly raising concerns about the future and the direction of travel and the certainty that they can expect from government.
I mean, what were the main concerns you feel raised this morning? Sorry, Hugo.
I think obviously the changes at the last budget to the sort of financial regimes that surround the oil and gas industry form quite a lot of our discussion. You know, governments of all parties, you know, do make changes to these taxes over time that sometimes are not popular. But I think what was really concerning was the way that the changes came out of the blue. There had been no indication that these changes were going to happen. And therefore, I think the industry rightly felt aggrieved at that and worried about what this meant with any other substantial or tinkering arrangements with the financial regimes that go forward. And, you know, what really came home to me out of the meeting we had was, you know, this is about the organisations involved being to have some certainty, but also the potential for investors into new projects, because those investors look at what the risks are, what the certainties are for a return and what they're investing. And, you know, sudden shocks to fiscal regimes and tax regimes isn't helpful to that sort of discussion and that onward investment, which is so crucial.
So, I mean, obviously it begs the question, I mean, what would Labour do? I mean, obviously taxes, you were saying taxes have to be rearranged, but would you have done it in that way?
Well, you know, the truth is that you know, we have a Tory-led government supported by Liberal Democrats in Westminster. They have made it their aim to get rid of the deficit over the lifetime of this Parliament, and therefore the decisions they're making about taxes and other things arise out of that, you know, basic policy. What I would say is that, you know, our plan was to halve the deficit over 4 years, and we would be doing some things in a different way. But I would like to feel that what we would do is, where there were going to be changes to different sectors, actually have some engagement with that sector so there aren't any sudden shocks coming down the way. But also we would do things in a way that we fully understand the implications. And as I said, you know, Labour sometimes did things in taxation that weren't always popular. But if I take the windfall tax on the utilities, that was in our manifesto. It was very clear that we were doing that. It wasn't something that just was sprung on a sector out of the blue. And I think that was what was most concerning about the decision by George Osborne and David Cameron in the last budget.
Will you be able to provide any assurances today to people in the meeting?
Well, we're in opposition, so we're not in government. What I can say is that I very much believe, and it's been reinforced today, how important the oil and gas industry is to our economy, but also to the energy sector. And that can sit very comfortably alongside our desire to develop opportunities in terms of renewables and other ways to clean up the energy sources that we already have. Actually, this was an agenda that Labour started in government. Elements of that are being supported by the present government, and we will continue to hold them to account. But, you know, at a time when unemployment is going up and growth across our countries is flatlining, you know, this is such an important part of the economic powerhouse for our country. But importantly, obviously, for Scotland, are the many jobs. 45% of the jobs in the oil and gas industry are actually located here in Scotland, particularly on the northeast. And that's something that, you know, it isn't about shareholders and dividends and big companies and politicians. It's about families in Aberdeen and beyond that really rely on this for their future potential and prospects.
Shadow Energy Minister Tom Greatex was also in attendance and said the talks had provided a great deal of food for thought.
Well, it was very useful meeting with Oil and Gas UK and some of their big members today for myself and for Caroline Flint, the Shadow Secretary of State, to get to understand some of the big issues facing the industry, some of the concerns and some of the things they'll be looking for government and parliament to address. The main concerns are around the fiscal regime, the ongoing debates around the fiscal regime, particularly after the changes the UK government made to the last budget, which have had a significant impact, not so much necessarily on activity, but also on the confidence that the industry has in there being a very consistent and predictable taxation regime. Issues around European regulation, which are currently very high on the agenda because that's something which has come about in the last, or suggestions of that have come about in the last couple of weeks, and around some more of the technical detailed issues around health and safety, decommissioning, and the future in terms of diversification into renewable energy.
Now, if we discuss the windfall tax, I suppose was the main criticism was how they did it. I mean, it was a massive shock for the industry.
It was. It was a huge shock. It was something which came, it was described to us today as a bolt from the blue. It was something which happened without any consultation, any discussion, any prior warning. And it has had an impact in that sense. It may not have had a direct impact in on particular projects that are currently that people have pulled out of, but it will have an impact on decisions that are being made about future projects. And in an industry like this, where so much of it is about long-term capital investment over periods of years, and the returns are going to happen over periods of years, then having as much predictability as possible in that fiscal regime is key. And that's a very strong message the industry have sent to the government in their discussions, and they're sending to us as the official opposition as we look to develop our policy agenda.
And I mean, is that something that you know you will be bringing to them? You know, maybe future decisions, you need to kind of step back and speak to industry members before you do anything.
Well, I think it's very, very important that in an industry like this, where so much is dependent on long-term decisions, that there aren't nasty surprises. I'm not saying that the government, of whatever political hue at whatever time, may not wish or need to change the fiscal regime, but that shouldn't be done in a way where there isn't any consultation or any discussion beforehand. I think it's vitally important that those that engagement with the industry happens and those potential changes are discussed ahead of them happening.
Now, I mean, obviously you said in the meeting that they're speaking about that there has already been an impact. Is there still a real fear that there will be more of an impact, say, on jobs, that sort of thing?
Well, I think there's a potential impact on projects for the future or investment decisions being made by companies that those investment decisions may be made towards another part of the world rather than the North Sea. And therefore, that would have then an impact on jobs and skills in the long term. That's something we don't want to see. We want to see this industry in this city and in this region thrive.
And what are you going to do with this information that you've gathered today?
Well, it will help us inform our policy agenda. We're developing our policy position on these issues, and it's very, very useful to have that engagement with industry, and we'll continue to do that over the period ahead because I think it's vital for all political parties, whether they're in government or in opposition, who aspire to be in government, to understand the concerns and issues that the industry raises. It's a vital industry for this part of the world. It's a vital industry for the whole of the UK. It's potentially a vital industry internationally. We need to do our best to try to protect that industry and to ensure that it develops as well as it can.
On Tuesday, delegates at a conference in Aberdeen were warned decommissioning in UK waters will come with a £47 billion price tag. The 8th annual North Sea Decommissioning Conference was held in the Ardo House Hotel. The main focus was a report produced by industry analysts Douglas Westwood and Deloitte. I ran through the key points of the research with Douglas Westwood Chairman James Westwood.
What we're doing in this report is to include the whole of the Northwest European continental shelf, or what is often incorrectly termed the North Sea region. So this time round, we're not only looking at the UK, but we're looking at the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway and Ireland.
So what kind of work is involved here to, in effect, clear up after the oil and gas industry?
Well, it's a great deal of work, but the main things that have to be done are the individual wells themselves have to be plugged and abandoned. So that's the process of well decommissioning. And this is a very large element of that work. In the case of the UK, it probably accounts for about 75% of the total cost. Then the platforms themselves have to be removed. So in the case of small platforms, this is fairly straightforward in so much the whole platform can be removed. When you get to the giants, the sort of things that exist out on 40s and the Brentfield, etc., the steel structures can actually be cut at 50-metre levels. and the platform topsides removed and the jackets removed. Then, of course, we have to actually take it back to the beach, and from there we have the various amounts of heavy transportation involved. And once we actually get it onto the beach, then it has to be the major units from the topsides have to be disassembled, and the steel and other materials recovered from recycling. So all in all, in the case of the UK, the total bill for that over, well, quite a lot of years, is going to amount to something of the order of £30 billion.
So what can the UK energy companies be doing to prepare for this massive scale of work?
Well, it is in terms of the supply chain, it is a case of making sure that they have the facilities available, because obviously this is work on a huge scale. And already, of course, we have decommissioning yards established in Shetlands, for example, and other yards around the coast of the UK, and obviously particularly in Scotland, that could be resurrected to do this type of work.
And obviously, workers' skills being up to date and training available for people to be able to undertake these jobs must play a massive part.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the probably the great concerns that we would have, because of course what everybody that's in the oil industry knows about the greying workforce, and we have an awful lot of people who are around retirement age, and so we need to actually develop the skills to be able to pull this whole thing off within a sensible time frame and at a sensible cost. So that means investing in skills, investing in education.
You mentioned the time frame there. What do you think the realistic time scale is in the coming years to get this work, you know, really underway?
Well, this going to begin on a reasonable scale in 2016 and gradually increase. And it's going to remain at a pretty high level until sometime past 2030. So, you know, we've got 25 years or more of quite a lot of activity. But at the moment, we have maybe 5 years before the industry really needs to get its act together.
And we have delegates considering this report today at conference in Aberdeen. So really, if you could just sum up for me what you think their priorities should be when they're round the table discussing decommissioning today.
Well, in terms of the companies in Scotland, the priority has to be to make sure that the resources exist as the demand builds up. Because the numbers that we produced in our report are based on two scenarios. The lowest cost scenario relies upon the existence of a new range of very heavy lift vessels. These are crane barges, crane vessels, which can actually move loads of something over 15,000 tonnes. So these vessels, however, would be transporting the whole of a topside in one lump back to the beach. So it is a pretty formidable undertaking to make sure that we have the resources there on the beach that could handle these things. If we don't have them in Scotland, then most certainly they will be developed in Norway. And indeed, there are plans underway at the moment for major dedicated decommissioning yards in Norway.
So is this something that you think the industry is taking in hand properly at the moment, or do you think more attention needs to be paid?
Well, indeed, more attention needs to be paid to the subject, because it is just so important, and there's just so much money that is that's going to be spent over that period of time. Probably something around the North Sea area of about £1.5 billion per annum for the next 30 years.
Pressure on the Chancellor to scrap the planned increase in fuel duty built up this week. A three-pence duty hike had been penciled in for January, but a motion calling for the government to rethink the move received unanimous backing in the House of Commons. The debate was triggered by an online e-petition signed by more than 100,000 people. Conservative backbencher Rob Halfen was the man behind the debate. He believes it's a pressing issue for the country.
We've got a motion signed by over 107 MPs, plus supported by over 100,000 people who've signed the Fair Fuel UK e-petition. It's about calling for lower petrol duties. This is the number one issue facing the country. It's crucifying families who can't afford to go shopping or take their kids to school. It's crucifying businesses who can't afford to drive a van or a lorry. And it's crucifying pensioners too, who can't afford bus fares because of the high cost of diesel. Well, there are three things that we are asking for. Number one is not to increase fuel duty anymore this Parliament, because we have amongst the highest fuel duty in Europe. Secondly, to cut fuel taxes in the long run. And thirdly, to set up a commission to look at the high cost of petrol and diesel, to look at longer term ways of reducing the cost of petrol. For example, we're asking the government to put pressure on the oil companies to reduce the cost of petrol and diesel at the pumps, because when the price goes high, the price at the pumps goes high, but when it goes low, it takes much longer to feed through at the pumps. High petrol prices are actually creating a poverty trap and causing immense hardship for many. In Harlow, my own constituency, the average motorist is paying £1,700 a year, roughly, on petrol prices, a tenth of their average earnings. The government defines fuel poverty as someone who spends a tenth of their income on fuel. In essence, motorists are facing fuel poverty.
The end of the week saw the publication of the latest Oil and Gas UK Business Confidence Index. It showed the industry remains cautious, with a 1-point drop from 54 to 53 on the 100-point scale. I spoke with Oil and Gas UK supply chain manager Kent Cruikshank about just what these figures mean.
Well, this index, the confidence index, is a summary of the confidence level of the operator and contractor members. What we're finding with it over the last two quarters since the huge decrease after the tax is it's stabilised around about the 50 mark, which means that in our interpretation the market is basically just waiting to see a more predictable tax regime coming out. They are all cautiously optimistic. Optimistic may be too strong, but cautiously awaiting the outcome of discussions taking place between industry and the Treasury, which we're involved in at the moment.
It's sitting right there, kind of just on the 50 mark. It's almost in a sense that everybody's holding their breath.
That's what it appears like to us. There's the oil industry issues, which we've said before, revolve around the tax take that came in March of this year. There's the wider implications of the global economy. But the big issues are predictability and stability in the oil and gas industry, which we feel is the major affecting issues which affect this confidence index.
So what does that mean for the industry as a whole? You know, if that's been the past few now that it's stabilised out at this level, like growth is always required in business. So how long can this feasibly go on for?
I guess it's how long's a piece of string. It's like any business, it needs to move forward to survive. But like any other business, they do require that predictability. The banks, the financing institutions, who are also cautious at the moment, are looking for that ongoing stability, both in the markets, the wider markets, and in particular the oil and gas market, which we are actively involved in.
So do you think that the tax issue is the biggest one for anybody concerned with the oil and gas industry at the moment? Do you think that would be the deciding factor should that change?
It is the one that caused the biggest drop in confidence earlier in the year. As you see from the graphs, there was a very marked reduction in confidence level at that time, which has not recovered. We're still below the level we were at this time last year, and that is the biggest single issue that we've identified. There are obviously others, but if we could sort out the tax issue in terms of production and then the decommissioning issues, then that would go a long way towards stabilising the confidence of the oil and gas community.
And there have been a variety of big announcements recently with different things going on. Let's say the BP announcement just in recent weeks. But will it take a while for that type of thing to show?
You will find that the big contracts like Clear Ridge and Golden Eagle were at a point where they were committed to move forward. They do still have good economics, and no one's doubting that. The problem is with the smaller marginal fields, where they are, as the name suggests, they are more marginal in terms of recovery of the product and in financial terms. And that's where the confidence is really needed to progress with the activity. And that activity could take a couple of years before it comes to the market, as has the bigger contracts that you're hearing about at the moment.
And oil workers scooped the top prize of a different kind at an awards ceremony in Aberdeen this week. NHS Grampians Healthy Working Life programme teaches cancer awareness, healthy eating and helps people quit smoking. Shell employees have been taking part at their Aberdeen offices and on the Nelson platform in the middle of the North Sea. Helen Griffith from the company spoke to us after they received a gold award for their efforts.
Well, this is an exciting award. In fact, it's an award which we've got on two areas of our business. On one of our offshore platforms, the Nelson platform, and within the Shell Tullis offices. So basically, it's an award which is given to companies that have developed a strategy and plan to actually help to improve the health of employees within our organisation. And the award is covers a large number of different components. It covers having a clear strategy, having a proactive lot of activities in place, and basically some mechanism to educate, to involve, to engage employees and contractor in actively improving their health.
Fantastic. And I mean, it's a wide spectrum of things, isn't it? From, say, cancer awareness, stopping smoking, to eating healthily.
Absolutely. It covers all aspects of health, from the physical aspects, such as you've just mentioned, to mental health aspects. And I think what's exciting is that it's not just a reactive approach which we're looking at here, it's actually a proactive approach. So, for example, if we think of mental health, we're taking it from reacting perhaps to perhaps people having stress in the workplace into a much more proactive activity of actually helping people to improve their resilience in terms of developing coping strategies. So I think there's been a huge lot of opportunities to move things forward.
Now, can you tell us what, I understand you had teams from the Shell offices in Tullis and also on the Nelson platform. Tell us what those two different teams, you know, got up to.
Well, if we take the offshore platform, they were clearly involved with looking at the health of a workforce operating in the harsh conditions of the offshore environment, but at the same time looking at their overall general health. So the platform medic worked with the platform management team, and they also involved some external companies to come in and give presentations, type of thing that you've described, things around men's health, things around cardiovascular health improvement, cancer awareness and so on. But in addition, there was a very positive community spirit which developed through the working for this programme, and a team from the Nelson came onshore and actually worked in the local community to do some hard work improving and renovating Sunnybank Park in Aberdeen. In terms of the Tullis, the office environment, again, we had slightly different environment. And within Tullis, we ran health fairs. And these were basically, I think, regarded as quite good fun for the workforce. People were able to come along, perhaps have some health checks done, get involved in some interactive physical type of activity, either individually or on a team basis. And then we would have a lots of demonstration things on alcohol awareness. People could actually look at how much the sort of components of alcohol drinks, the number of units. And then when we're looking at tobacco and nicotine, actually looking at how much tar you would actually find if you smoked a number of cigarettes. So lots of interactive things. We also have been able to work closely with our caterers, both on and offshore, looking to support healthy eating. And again, that has got involvement from the workforce as well.
And I mean, I think you touched on it there. You said a lot of them found it very good fun. I mean, did this really kind of, you know, bring your employees together? And it does sound like they did have a good time doing it.
I certainly think it did. Certainly within my own team, it was a good spirit engendered, and the community activities, the sort of health fair activities, I think people did really enjoy those as well. Well, it really is wonderful for us to have received the Gold Award for two different areas of our business. And I think it reflects the hard work that has been put in, not just by one or two people, but a huge number of people working together, you know, within teams to pull this award together.
And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester.
North Sound Energy Week.